Hello, welcome back to the MJA podcast. My name's Kate Swanell. Our topic for today is deep vein thrombosis. A narrative review published in the MJA carries some good advice for primary care physicians about diagnosis of DVT and the high level of suspicion needed. Dr. Paul Kruger, a haematologist at Fiona Stanley Hospital in Perth, is an author of the review, and he is my special guest today. Deep vein thrombosis, what is it, how does it present, and how is it clinically diagnosed?
Deep vein thrombosis, which I'll call DVT from now on, mm-hmm. It's a collection of platelets and fibrin and other blood cells which form a thrombus inside a vein. And I think in this podcast we'll concentrate on DVT in the leg, but it can also happen in the arm and in other veins in the body, such as in the abdominal intracranial.
So how does it present usually?
Well, usually DVT presents as leg pain, leg swelling, erythema of the skin, and sometimes dilated veins. And the location of those symptoms really depends on the location of the DVT. For example, if the DVT is in the proximal leg, and by proximal leg, I mean the proximal veins, proximal to the popliteal vein, those symptoms happen in the upper leg. Alternatively, if the DVT is distal, and by distal I mean distal to the popliteal vein, those symptoms might happen in the lower leg. And there is a big difference actually between proximal and distal DVT, because proximal DVT has a much higher risk of extension and embolisation compared to distal DVT.
Once a GP, for example, suspects DVT, what's the next step in getting it formally diagnosed?
So the next step is some investigation. And the investigations are super important because a clinical assessment might just reveal unclear symptoms or unclear signs of DVT. So we rely heavily on the D-dimer and the ultrasound of the leg. So the D-dimer is a very helpful blood test. It's helpful if the result is negative, because a negative D-dimer has a very high negative predictive value, and it can make us confidently exclude a DVT in a patient and then go on to investigate for other causes. However, when the D-dimer test is positive, the patient needs further investigation, for example, an ultrasound of the leg, and that's to look for signs of the DVT, which, in other words, it's an occlusive thrombus. There'd be loss of the normal blood flow in the vein and loss of compressibility of the vein.
What are the consequences of untreated DVT?
Well, if a DVT is not treated, we worry about two major problems. The first is post-thrombotic syndrome, which refers to long-term pain and long-term swelling of the affected limb. And the second major consequence is pulmonary embolism if part of the DVT from the leg or the pelvis or the arm detaches from its original site and spreads up through the inferior vena cava and lodges in the pulmonary artery. Pulmonary embolism, as you could imagine, is associated with much higher morbidity and mortality than DVT.
So let's talk about treatment. What are the gold standards for treatment of DVT?
So the gold standard treatment for DVT is anticoagulation first and foremost, and the sooner a patient started on anticoagulation treatment, the quicker their symptoms would resolve and they would be less likely to develop the nasty complications of post-thrombotic syndrome and pulmonary embolism. Now, in 2019, we're very lucky. There are lots of options for anticoagulation treatment. In the 1900s, it was really heparin, low molecular weight heparin and warfarin. But now in the 2000s, we've also got the direct oral anticoagulants available, which are rivaroxaban, apixaban and dabigatran, and overseas is edoxaban as well. Now, there's so many choices. I try to simplify these choices in my head as parenteral, in other words, heparin, low molecular weight heparin, etc., versus oral, which are the vitamin K antagonists or a direct oral anticoagulant.
What's the mechanism behind the DOACs being better than the parenterals?
The DOACs have a few advantages over parenterals. I think efficacy is a significant advantage, and we know that the efficacy of the DOACs is very good from the phase 3 randomised trials of dabigatran and rivaroxaban and apixaban, all compared to warfarin. In the trials, the DOACs were non-inferior to warfarin for the outcomes of recurrent DVT or recurrent VTE. And the outcomes in some of the trials were recurrent VTE or VTE-related death. So the DOACs were non-inferior to warfarin for that. But in addition, the DOACs had a lower risk of bleeding compared to warfarin in the phase 3 trials. And then on top of all of that is that the DOACs have many practical advantages compared to warfarin. For example, the DOACs are very predictable in their anticoagulant effect. The DOACs work very quickly after the tablet's swallowed. Warfarin takes a lot longer, obviously. It takes many days to reach steady state.
Right.
The DOACs, another advantage is that the DOACs are administered in a fixed dose. There's no need to change the dose, and there's no need for routine monitoring of DOACs. And the DOACs also interact with far fewer medications compared to warfarin. So, in other words, the DOACs are very effective, very safe, with lots of practical advantages, which
yep.
are very appealing to a lot of patients.
How does the treatment of DVT change if the patient has cancer?
Well, cancer is a very strong risk factor for venous thromboembolism, DVT and PE. So for many years now, the standard treatment of VTE in patients with cancer has been low molecular weight heparin,
mm-hmm.
because low molecular weight heparin has shown a lower risk of recurrent VTE compared to warfarin, and the risk of bleeding is fairly similar with the two treatments. The problem is, though, many patients prefer not to have daily injections of molecular weight heparin over the long term. There's good news. We now have more anticoagulant options because last year, two trials of the DOACs for treatment of DVT in patients with cancer were published. The first trial is the SELECT-D trial, which compared rivaroxaban and dalteparin in about 400 patients with cancer who mm-hmm. had a VTE. And the results show that there was a lower risk of VTE recurrence at 6 months with rivaroxaban, about 4%, versus dalteparin, about 11%. The increased efficacy came with a higher risk of major bleeding, however. There was more bleeding with rivaroxaban, about 6%, versus about 4% with dalteparin, and the bleeding was mostly seen in patients who had a gastrointestinal cancer. The second trial was of edoxaban compared to low molecular weight heparin or dalteparin, and the results of this trial showed that there was, once again, a lower rate of recurrent VTE in patients who had edoxaban compared to dalteparin, but also a higher risk of major bleeding edoxaban versus dalteparin. So I think to summarise all of this evidence for treatment of VTE in patients who have cancer, I would say that low molecular weight heparin is a very effective treatment which has been used for many years, but we now have new data showing that two of the DOACs, rivaroxaban and edoxaban, are other very good options as well. It seems that these two DOACs have higher efficacy than low molecular weight heparin, but at the cost of increased bleeding. I should highlight that the increased risk of bleeding seems to be in patients who have gastrointestinal cancer, and that's one specific group that I would probably not use a DOAC in at this stage.
I'm chatting today with Paul Kruger, a haematologist, and one of the lead authors of a new narrative review on DVT, which you can find at mja.com.au. Don't forget that you can subscribe to our podcasts using iTunes. It's free, and you'll be notified every time a new podcast drops. Back to our chat with Paul. Apart from patients with cancer, are there other patients for whom the DOACs or anticoagulants in general are not effective for DVT?
Yes, there are a few patients. So whenever I meet a patient with DVT, I always consider whether they're appropriate or not for a DOAC therapy. And
mm-hmm.
fortunately, most patients are appropriate. But there's a small minority of patients in whom I would not prescribe a DOAC. These include, firstly, patients with renal impairment, and the cutoffs are slightly different for the different DOACs. So
mm-hmm.
basically, if a patient has a creatinine clearance of less than 30 mils a minute, then they should not be treated with rivaroxaban, 15 or 20 milligrams,
mm-hmm.
or dasigatran or edoxaban. Then patients who have creatinine clearance less than 25 mils a minute should not receive apixaban. And just recently, rivaroxaban 10 milligram tablets became available in Australia, and these should not be given to patients with a creatinine clearance less than 15. In addition to that, pregnant women should not receive DOAC, and patients with antiphospholipid syndrome should not receive DOACs until we get more evidence.
Yeah.
And finally, patients in whom we know they've had adverse effects on DOACs previously obviously should not have DOACs again.
So what are the treatment options for DVT in those patients?
Well, for patients with renal impairment, I still prefer to treat them with warfarin for long-term anticoagulation. For pregnant women, low molecular weight heparin is still the safest anticoagulant. And for patients with antiphospholipid syndrome, again, I prefer warfarin for long-term anticoagulation or enoxaparin for short-term. There is one non-pharmaceutical treatment, which is compression stocking. There's quite mixed evidence for compression stockings, but stockings can be helpful in patients who have pain and swelling, which improves with the compression. But in my practice, anticoagulation is by far the most important and effective treatment for DVT.
In your review, you mention inferior vena cava filters, thrombolysis and surgical thrombus removal. Are they rarely used?
Yes, they're rarely used, mainly because filters and thrombolysis and thrombus removal require expertise, which is usually only available in a large hospital. It may not be convenient to patients who live remotely or rurally.
Once somebody's had DVT, what are the chances of them getting it again, and how do we stop that happening?
Well, the chances of recurrent DVT really depend on the patient's clinical risk factors.
Mm.
So when a patient develops their DVT, we always take a careful history for the risk factors, and we determine whether a patient has a transient risk factor, which means that the risk factor is only present for a short period of time, for example, surgery, or for example, pregnancy or trauma. The next major category of risk factors is permanent or persisting, and as the name suggests, these are risk factors which persist for a much longer period of time, for example, chronic inflammation or cancer, which is not curable. And finally, patients who do not have temporary or persisting risk factors, we call them patients have an unprovoked DVT. So the risk of recurrence really depends on what type of risk factors the patient has. The lowest risk of recurrence occurs in patients who have a transient or a temporary provoking factor, with higher risk of recurrence in patients with a permanent persisting factor or in patients with unprovoked DVT.
Are there any lifestyle modifications that can help lower the risk of DVT?
I think lifestyle modifications are always helpful no matter what. I think maintaining a healthy weight and good mobility, regular exercise are very helpful to reduce the risk of DVT. But clearly there are lots of other factors at play, and if anyone ever develops any abnormal symptoms or signs, they should seek medical attention.
Where's the research going in this field, Paul? Is it about prevention, or is the research about better treatment?
I think both, Kate. I think there's more research about primary prevention when patients are about to, for example, have elective surgery. But most of the work is done on treatment in terms of defining the optimal anticoagulant and the optimal time period to treat with anticoagulation, and the optimal secondary prevention after patients have completed their initial treatment with anticoagulant therapy.
Superficial vein thrombosis, is it a significant part of the whole deal?
Yes, superficial vein thrombosis is important because it can be associated with a higher risk of proximal DVT or pulmonary embolism. So when a patient presents with superficial vein thrombosis, I try to clarify the extent of the thrombosis with an ultrasound. Also, another reason for the ultrasound is to confirm that there's no deep vein thrombosis. So usually a short period of anticoagulation treatment is appropriate for superficial vein thrombosis, and by short, anywhere from 2 weeks up to 6 weeks or so, depending on the patient's symptoms and how they respond. Some patients who have a very short segment of superficial vein thrombosis may in fact respond to topical nonsteroidals for treatment of pain, but it really depends on the extent and the severity of the symptoms.
Would you do a D-dimer and then do an ultrasound?
Well, that's a difficult question. I think if a patient's symptomatic and they have a palpable or even a visible abnormality, I'd probably treat with anticoagulation regardless to alleviate symptoms and reduce the risk of tension and the risk of DVT. A D-dimer is not often helpful in a patient who's symptomatic because they often require anticoagulation treatment anyway.
Thanks for your time, Paul.
Pleasure. Have a great day. Thanks, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.